Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
All right, we are good to go whenever.
Hello and welcome to the Talking About podcast. I am Sean Kennedy. Unfortunately, my usual co-host this week, Daniel Olinger, is not able to join us. But we have a great guest for you all. It's Jackson Frank of our own Liberty Ballers and a lot of other things as well. Dime and the Step Back, and you can find him on the Locker Room app doing some pods. Always great content from Jackson. We're happy to have you. How are you, Jackson?
I'm doing pretty well. Appreciate you having me on. I'm bummed that we don't get Daniel as well, but luckily I was able to talk some Sixers with Daniel yesterday afternoon before, you know, whatever occupied him today. But happy to be here and talk some more Sixers.
Great. So, yeah, game one is Sunday at 1 p.m. between the Sixers and Hawks. We don't have the rest of the second round schedule out, but before we pivot to the Atlanta series, I just wanted to kind of take a look back at the first round series against Washington. Obviously, the kind of all-encompassing news around Philadelphia basketball right now is the status of Joel Embiid. He was injured in the Game 4 loss and missed Game 5, but he was out in pregame warm-ups and doing some shooting and kind of looked to be, you know, moving around at regular speed. That is going to be the big question as to whether he'll be available sooner rather than later for the Sixers. But Embiid aside for the moment, what about the series against Washington surprised you the most, or maybe either encouraged you or discouraged you about the Sixers' chances in this postseason, Jackson?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I feel like every time I've talked about this series and the Sixers as of late, Tyrese Maxey has come up in some form or another. I mean, Daniel and I spent, you know, probably 15 minutes talking about him on my podcast earlier this week. But I think that's got, like, just the way his role seemed to kind of grow so quickly in that series. I mean, obviously, some of it was born out of necessity, and they needed someone who could create shots once Embiid was out. And I mean, he played 26 minutes in game five was the fifth, I think he played the fifth most minutes in that game. You know, Matisse Thybulle started, but, you know, before Doc emptied the bench, you know, Tyrese was the one playing a lot of minutes with that starting unit. So I think that plus maybe Seth Curry's, you know, game, I thought he was, you know, even before game five, I thought he was pretty aggressive getting to his spots and finding shots off the dribble. You know, a lot of people compared him to JJ Redick, but I think it's clear that he has a different game than JJ Redick. He has a little more off the bounce ability, and you saw him be pretty comfortable and confident getting to his shots, which has kind of been a pretty major question, you know, talking point, I guess is the best way to phrase it, around Seth Curry. At times he's looked really confident getting to his spots and being aggressive, and other times he's been a little more gun shy. So he's going to be kind of key, I think, for the Sixers, especially with, you know, forever long Embiid is, you know, out. But I even think with Embiid, you need Seth Curry to be aggressive finding his shots. So I would say those two things were the biggest surprises to me. Everything else I kind of expected going. I thought Tobias would play well against a team like the Wizards, didn't have a big front line. I thought Ben would play well, you know, too, and we saw both of those things. But the guard play from a couple of, you know, kind of complimentary players is really what stood out most to me in that series.
Yeah, the Seth JJ comparison, I get why people make it, but as you said, they have very different games. Curry is a guy who can kind of create for himself a little bit and take guys off the dribble, whereas JJ is a guy who's going to run off screens at 100 miles an hour, and he has the much quicker release, and he is much more capable of, or at least JJ when he was with the Sixers, I don't know so much anymore as he gets up there in age, but he's able to, you know, fly sideways at full speed and fire it up, whereas Seth needs to be a little more set, and his release is much slower. Mm-hmm. But I understood the comparison because as JJ and Joel had that great two-man partnership with the DHOs and everything, Seth has certainly inherited a bit of that role within the offense. Yeah, and then Tyrese, as you said, I think this is just unexpected, not because we didn't think he was capable of this down the road, but just Doc Rivers and his history playing rookies in the postseason and the fact that the Sixers do have, you know, a lot of bench options that he goes to. I just think everyone kind of thought that would preclude Maxey from really emerging this postseason, but it's been tremendous to watch. He's a huge fan favorite. It seems like the arena is completely energized whenever he's on the court. But I guess it kind of goes hand in hand with his emergence and Shake Milton's struggles in the first round, with some of Shake's usual minutes and role kind of getting passed along to Maxey. What did you think of Shake's first round series, and are you concerned going forward about that?
Yeah, honestly, it kind of was reminiscent of Shake his rookie year. I mean, if you recall, I felt like every time Shake played his rookie year, things just kind of seemed like he just seemed out of place. Like the game was too quick for him. He struggled with physicality. He couldn't really score very effectively. And Shake's made huge strides the last couple of years, but it just felt like he was pressing and trying to do things in a way that weren't there. I mean, I want to say maybe he hit four or five shots in that series. Again, he didn't play a ton of minutes. I mean, but he just struggled whenever he got any sort of like semblance of rotation minutes, even though they were scarce. He was, you know, whether it was a poor closeout or he forced up a shot through contact that didn't need to be taken. He just didn't have it in this series. It wasn't the Shake that, like, I think that has made himself into a viable rotation guard for this team in the NBA for most of his last couple of years. I think it's obviously better than he was as a rookie, but it felt like that in the sense that, like, he was just out of sorts a lot throughout this series, and that's kind of the way that Shake was at times as a rookie, and part of the reason he struggled in the moments that he did get playing time, you know, when he was kind of bouncing between the Sixers and the Blue Coats. So, yeah, I think that's my interpretation of it, but just didn't really play the style that I thought we saw when Shake was at his best this year, and even last year to an extent.
For sure. It was weird because it wasn't just a case of, oh, the shots aren't falling. He definitely looked a lot of, like, very much out of sorts, and there was some poor dribbling. He was making bad decisions with the ball, you know, looking to find his teammates. It just wasn't a case of, oh, well, he was getting to his spots, and those are shots he normally knocks down, and just, you know, simple variance, they didn't happen to go in. He just didn't look like the same guy we saw for much of the season. It was a strange series for him, but, you know, Doc, after Game 5, said that he still believes in Shake, and he's going to win a couple games for him moving forward. So I don't think we've seen the last of Shake Milton, and hopefully he is able to turn it around moving forward in this, starting with this Atlanta series. So let's, you know, move along to our second round matchup here in Philadelphia. Atlanta, after their Game 5 win against the Knicks, they are poised to come to Philadelphia for Game 1 on Sunday. So I guess we'll start with, if Embiid is not available immediately, I know you've discussed and mentioned about all the rim protection issues that arise when Joel isn't on the court, and how that kind of hurts guys like Ben and Matisse, who could be a little more aggressive in their coverage of perimeter guys, which is going to be huge with Trae Young because Joel isn't back there as that security blanket. Is there anything the Sixers can really do, or if Joel's not in there, how do you foresee them, like, tackling that challenge of Embiid not being there in the paint?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I think you saw such a huge discrepancy even when they went from small ball to Dwight Howard at the five in game five. And, you know, Dwight is I thought he was a pretty good rim protector, especially for a backup big this year, but he's not Joel, right? And you can't play Dwight that many minutes because you can't, like, you don't want to play him with Ben very much because the spacing there is just really tough. So I don't have a great answer, honestly. I think the fact of the matter is, as long as Joel's out, they're probably, especially against a team like the Hawks that have two great lob threats in Collins and Capella, and then also shooters around, you know, Trae Young and whatnot. Because what I thought the Sixers did better as Game 5 progressed against the Wizards, they realized, okay, the Wizards don't really have any shooting, you know, with Bertans out of, you know, with Bertans nursing his strained calf. Like, they have Helen Neto, but then when they played Neto, Seth Curry just decided, okay, I'm going to use my size advantage, which Seth Curry doesn't have a huge size advantage over many guys, but Neto was one of them. And that forced Scott Brooks to put Ish Smith in the game, and the Sixers just loaded up so much help in the paint off of shooters to stop Russell Westbrook and Bradley Beal, and you can't do that against the Hawks. You know, they have Kevin Huerter, they have Bogdan Bogdanovic, you know, Danilo Gallinari, Collins can space the floor now as a shooter as well. So I don't think there's a great answer. I think it's going to have to be that, you know, Dwight is really good in the minutes he does get. I imagine Dwight will play, you know, anywhere from 12 to 15 minutes as long as Joel's out, and even when Joel comes back, maybe a little bit less. But and then Ben's gonna have to be, Ben or Tobias is gonna be, have to be good in those rim protection scenarios. I mean, Tobias is kind of playing the de facto five when that starting lineup, in the sense that, you know, Ben may have been the tallest guy out there, but Tobias was the one hanging around the paint a lot and, you know, kind of being asked to help at the rim and stuff. So there's really not a great answer because they, I mean, just because they don't like, it'd be great if they had a stretch five who could also, you know, protect the rim because they could play him with Ben more, but that's a very valuable commodity. There aren't many guys who can space the floor as a five and offer a lot of high level rim protection. So it's gonna, I mean, it's cliche, but it's gonna be a team effort. It's gonna require Tobias and Ben to protect the rim better than they have throughout most of their career, and it's also gonna require Dwight to be disciplined and, you know, not chase all those blocks that we've seen him kind of do throughout his career in this year, where he kind of unnecessarily kind of leaves his feet and the guy gets an offensive rebound or something like that, or a putback. So you know, group effort sounds cliche, but it honestly is a case when you're trying to make up for a guy like Joel Embiid, who is a, you know, I think at his peak is a top one or two center in the NBA defensively. You just can't really replicate that, especially now that they kind of, I mean, they lost Tony Bradley, they traded Vincent Poirier as well. So it's just kind of tough options there. It's going to be going to require kind of very a lot of diligence from the guys who are there.
It certainly is, and Doc said get that game five win was an all hands on deck situation, and it seems like it's going to have to be that moving forward, unless they get a good prognosis on Joel's meniscus and he is ready to go sooner than expected. Yeah, Tobias is, you mentioned him being the de facto five, and he was guarding Daniel Gafford a lot, and we've seen that in past postseasons too, where they will put him on a Marc Gasol or a Brook Lopez if they want, in the Milwaukee games where they wanted Embiid on Giannis, and there was the playoff series against the Raptors where that kind of cross switch really worked out well for the Sixers. So he is a guy that can like body those bigger guys up and do a good job keeping them off the boards. But yeah, as you said, the rim protection just becomes such an issue because, you know, Ben, as great a defender as he is, he's not the prototypical guy who's gonna, you know, stop guy. His presence down there doesn't dissuade people from attacking. And then Tobias is not, he's not a big leaper or anything, so he's not filling that role. What did you think about Matisse's insertion into the starting lineup against Washington, and do you think that would be something that Doc is going to stick with against Atlanta?
Yeah, I mean, I understood it. I got the idea that like you wanted to go with more defense, like you trusted your offense enough to get the job done against, you know, a Wizards team that just didn't have the size to match, you know, Ben and Tobias mostly. So I understood it, but I honestly thought for the most part this is like, you know, maybe beyond, I thought game one, Matisse was pretty good defensively. In game two, obviously, he had that ridiculous, what was like five blocks and four steals in 18 minutes, 19 minutes. But I honestly thought this was one of Matisse's kind of least impactful defensive stretches of the season. And he talked about it after game five that, like, he learned, like, against Bradley Beal, he, like, discipline, discipline, discipline. He's gotten better at that this year. Like, it's much better than his rookie season, but you could still tell there were times where Beal kind of knew how to bait Matisse into lunging for a steal or a block, and using that to his advantage. And Matisse talked about that. He's like superstar offensive players, no defensive players tendencies, just as superstar defensive players, no offensive players tendencies. And typically the offense is going to win out there, and that's what happened. So I didn't mind it at all. And I mean, Doc is a guy who, you know, is very comfortable starting one guy, but, you know, if another player has kind of the hot hand, he'll roll with them as kind of the fifth piece in a starting lineup. And you, I mean, you saw that with Maxey. So I understood it, but I don't know if it can work moving forward as much because because the Hawks are a much better, you know, offensive team. At the same time, you know, you don't want to scheme an entire plan around what, how do you kind of, you know, combat Trae Young. But if you just let the Hawks put Trae Young on Matisse Thybulle, you're kind of letting them off the hook, just as kind of the Knicks did with Reggie Bullock. And Bullock's even a better offensive player than Matisse. So we'll see what they do. Doc said he did not consider starting Maxey in game five, which I, so I, that wouldn't convey to me that he'll consider doing it in game one or as long as Joel is out. But I understood kind of, you know, the idea behind Matisse. But I do wonder if you might want someone a little more offensively inclined, to not kind of let Trae Young off the hook, because then you have five guys who are a threat. And if Trae Young wants to guard Danny Green, by all means, I think Danny Green will just he'll hit five open threes in the first 14 minutes, doing the classic Danny Green cut, because Trae Young is not a very good off-ball defender, has not shown a kind of a, I guess, a discipline on that end. I mean, Bullock was open a lot. The Knicks just didn't have the offensive talent. And while the Sixers aren't an elite offensive team, they're certainly a step up from the Knicks.
Yeah, I know a big criticism again among Knicks fans in their first round series of the Hawks was just Tibbs not doing enough to hunt out Trae Young when the Knicks had the ball and not seeking to exploit that mismatch and really make him work defensively. How do you think Doc is going to best attack that, and what arrangements do you think he can make to try to get Trae Young on a switch on a mismatch, or how do you think Doc's going to approach that situation?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I'm trying to think back. I don't think we've seen a ton of, you know, really, really porous defenders that Doc, you know, throughout the year has like made an emphasis to target, because they've had Joel, and Joel, I mean, Joel's like, he is, I mean, I think when the Sixers were fully healthy, they're probably maybe like a fringe top 10, you know, offense. I don't think they quite ended there, but I mean, Joel missed 21 games, so it's tough to say, but they didn't really have to worry about that, right? Because Joel was so good in the post and kind of doing his thing from all over the floor. But I think the way to go about it is, it seems simple, but just use Trey's defender as a screener. If he's guarding Matisse, if he's guarding Danny Green, Seth Curry, like, you know, run those kind of inverted pick and rolls that you'll see that we saw a lot with like Joel and JJ Redick years past. Like get Tobias as the ball handler, Ben as the ball handler, and see if the Hawks will, like, can you set a good screen so that Trey can't just like show on the ball screen and then recover to his man, whoever it is. Like, force him onto a switch against Ben Simmons, Tobias Harris. Like, really involve him in the action. And again, you don't want to run an entire offense through just, you know, targeting Trae Young. But you do have to make him work. You do have to kind of make him feel you defensively. And kind of, you know, I don't want to say rough him up, of course. But you want to kind of offer some physicality on defense that maybe drains some of his offensive energy, because he does so much on that end. And I think part of the reason he was so good against the Knicks is because they just couldn't make him work. And so kind of involve him in more action and force him to really kind of commit himself on that end at times. Again, you don't want to stray away from what's worked offensively, but I think there are enough ways to kind of blend attacking Trae Young defensively into what you already do on that end at times.
Yeah, it's a different offense for the Sixers when they don't have Joel, because give it to the guy on the nail and he'll hit over 50% of his one-footed mid-range jumpers is something that you don't really need to scheme for. That's just, you got the great player, go out there and let him be great. So this was mentioned in Game 5 when Doc, in his post-game, said, yeah, you don't want a situation where you're missing your best player, but it does create an interesting challenge for you as a coach, because suddenly you have this problem that wasn't there before, and you have to kind of go back to the drawing board and come up with new ways to allow your team to succeed. So, yeah, if Joel's not in there, it's going to be interesting to see how the offense kind of evolves. And they did a good job in Game 5, but Washington is, you know, as it's well documented, they're not a good defensive team, and it didn't. There was a ton of mismatches the Sixers were able to exploit in that series that just won't be there against an Atlanta team that has a lot longer wing defenders. That, like, Washington was just playing guards and big men. They really didn't even have any wings, to combat the Sixers. And you know, Clint Capella is an excellent defender on the interior. So yeah, it's a much tougher challenge for the Sixers, and it exacerbates their potential difficulties if Joel's not in there. Shifting to when Atlanta does have the ball, obviously the number one focus is going to be stopping Trae Young, who averaged over 32 points a game on the road in their first round series. So his, you know, first time on the premier stage, he really stepped up and, you know, did everything you could want him to do if you're an Atlanta fan. His ability to stretch the floor, I think he shot somewhere around 36% this year on shots of 30 plus feet, is something the Sixers are going to have to account for. How exactly do they attack that? Because I know if they try to come out too far, and that can create, you know, opportunities in the paint for their rollers, who you said both Capella and John Collins are great rollers, and the Sixers won't have that rim protection in there. How would you go about, you know, tackling the Trae issue, and what defensive schemes do you think will work best for the Sixers in this series?
Yeah, that's, I mean, this is, I think, obviously an offense, you miss Joel, of course, because of all he can do is just, you know, self-create. He said just kind of dump the ball on him with the elbow or the mid-post and let him do his thing. But I think on defense, kind of especially schematically in this matchup, is where you miss him, because, you know, we've seen Joel play up more at times in pick and rolls, and you saw him hedge and trap somewhat in this series. You've seen him do that throughout the year. And I think that would have been something you would have seen a lot in this series because Trey loves getting to that floater. I mean, he crushed the Knicks with it because he was always able to get kind of 2 feet in the paint, and they had to decide between taking away the Capella lob or the Trey floater, and the Knicks weren't able to really kind of balance that well. And so I think Joel's presence would have been huge there. But I think similarly, the goal, I mean, just has to be to limit Trey's paint touches, right? Because he's not a great finisher, but he's very good at that floater. And if he gets deep enough, he'll make kind of either the wraparound pass to Capella or the lob over the top, or if the defense collapses too much, they'll have shooters in either corner. And he's a brilliant passer off of a live dribble. So I think that's got to be you really. I think you have to probably be aggressive defensively, but at the same time, Trey is, you know, I don't want to say trap him because Trey throughout his career, you know, I think, you know, just anecdotally, I don't have the numbers. I think he's done very well against traps because he is such a good passer. And if you do that, then you leave yourself susceptible to Trey throwing countless lobs and stuff and creating easy layups for Collins or Capella. So I think it's gonna have to be like, you know, Ben's gonna have to be great getting around screens. They love to run kind of those early action, you know, kind of those double drag screens up top in the early offense. And I think Ben's gonna have to be great getting around those. It's a tough ask. I mean, Ben's improved a lot with the screen navigation, but Trey is kind of the exact archetype who still gives Ben some issues, kind of the quick shifty guards who, you know, are just working from kind of a speed and a speed advantage, I guess is the best way to put it. Even though Ben is incredibly fast, especially for his size. But that's the biggest thing is just not letting Trey kind of get the corner. I mean, you never want an offensive player like of Trey's caliber to kind of get the edge and get an advantage there. But especially in this matchup where you're kind of lacking on the back end a little bit, it's going to require a very, very good defensive, you know, series from Ben. And I think he's certainly shown, you know, the potential to be up to the task. It's just a matter of going out and doing it. But it's a tough ask because his offensive responsibilities are also increasing the situation.
Yeah, they sure are, and you're right that Trey is the archetype of the small like water bug point guard that has really given the Sixers trouble over the years. He had the 39-point game last year, and even though the Sixers won in April, Trey did put up 32. He got to the line 10 times. It's just never something the Sixers have really had an answer for, and I think a lot of that might fall on Matisse, and hopefully, you know, you said the first round series for him was not very good, but maybe that, like, learning those lessons playing a top superstar guard like Bradley Beal, he can kind of, you know, take some things from that and apply it to his efforts against Trey in this upcoming series, because I think, you know, especially with Ben, if they go smaller, like having him on then the Hawks' smallest guy, that kind of creates mismatches elsewhere with the Hawks being a team that's got pretty good size themselves. So looking back at the regular season games, it's weird in that both these teams never really had a full strength game against each other. The Sixers were only with nine guys in the first game that Atlanta won, and then the two games in April, Atlanta was basically playing like a skeleton crew in the game. The Sixers won by 40 plus, and then they still had a couple, or I think three of their main rotation guys were out for that second game, even though Trey and a couple others were back in the game. But what in those matchups, was there anything you can kind of take away that, hey, the Sixers had success doing that? And again, the Embiid thing is the question, but what takeaways can you have from those regular season meetings, if any?
Yeah, I mean it's so tough because as you mentioned, key guys were out of each matchup. I mean, you know, Joel went off in the first half of that game back in January, and then the Hawks kind of, you know, I think Trae Young had a really good game, and then the Joel didn't play past like the 8 minute mark or something in the third quarter. And then Bogdan Bogdanovic, you had a very, very, very good year for the Hawks, missed both of those late season matchups. So, I mean, like they started Brandon Goodwin and Willie Williams and Solomon Hill in the first time that when they played in Atlanta. Trae Young played the second, or when they played Atlanta, excuse me. Trae Young played the second time in that kind of that 2 games in 3 days, as you mentioned. But I don't know how much there's a takeaway because, like, I mean, Goodwin and Hill aren't in the rotation right now. Like, and so I mean, Chris Dunn played 15 minutes. Chris Dunn had that kind of that scuffle with I think it was Matisse Thybulle or something like that. I don't recall exactly, but I can't take away a ton. I just know that, like, you know, when Trae did play, he and Capella had a really nice chemistry in lobs. And that's something that even with Joel, they've, you know, I think Joel improved a lot in kind of playing those one-on-two situations as a pick-and-roll defender, but it's still something that he has struggled with maybe more so than other elite centers because he is a little more ground bound, right? He's not some explosive vertical leaper in the way that, he doesn't quite have that same level of, just, I don't know exactly what the phrase is, but you look at a guy like even Myles Turner or Rudy Gobert, two of the other kind of preeminent defensive centers, I think they're a little better at that than Joel is, even if he's improved. So that's the biggest thing, is I think they're probably going to struggle to take away that lob threat from Capella. And so it's a matter of figuring out ways to at least slow it a little bit. But that's kind of the thing that I took away there. But as you said, it's just tough because so many key guys were out of these series and of this kind of this three-game series in the regular season. So I don't have a ton to offer in terms of insight from those games because I don't think they presented a ton of relevant information beyond the fact that I think the Sixers will have their hands full taking away that Trae Young Capella two-man game. Even if Joel was playing, I think they'd be more capable of it. But for as long as he's out, if at all, in this series, they'll have even more struggles, in this matchup.
Yeah, Joel doesn't have that kind of quick twitch explosiveness
yeah.
that a lot of like rim running lob threat centers have in the NBA. He's obviously very athletic and he's good laterally, like staying with smaller guards, and he has terrific defensive instincts, and that kind of makes up for it when he is in those 1-on-2 situations. But yeah, that is an area that if you're picking nits about Joel's overall defensive game, that's certainly one of his weaker areas. And then you have Dwight, who against a Atlanta team that was top two in free throw rate this year, and Dwight's foul difficulties are well documented at this point. You got to hope he can be a little smarter out there, especially in games that Joel isn't available. It's certainly going to be a potential challenge for the Sixers.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
So we talked a lot about Trae Young. Among the Hawks' supporting cast, you mentioned Bogdanović, who had a great year for them, shooting 43% from three, and the whole Milwaukee situation going awry was a huge boon for them. He's been one of their most important players this season, and a big reason they've exceeded expectations getting to the second round. So it could be him, but anyone else among the supporting cast, who do you think has come on lately, or who do you think is the worst matchup for Philadelphia in this upcoming series?
Yeah, I think Bogdan has to be kind of, if we're outside of Trae, has to be priority number one, because he is so good on and off the ball. That's why he's slid in so well next to Trae, because when Trae plays, they'll just run him through those pin downs, those floppy actions, and he's so good at creating space off of those screens, and he can shoot off movement. That's like, okay, then Trae will just facilitate the offense, and then when Trae sits down, we can play Bogdan, and he can run, a few pick and rolls for the 12 minutes Trae is out there, Trae out of the game in those 3 minute increments or so. So that's kind of priority number one. But I think it will depend on who Doc decides to start in Joel Embiid's place, as long as Joel is out. Because if they go Matisse again, I think you can feel reasonably confident in the matchups if you like between just balancing Matisse and Ben on Trae and Bogdan. But if you start a guy like George Hill or a guy like I don't think he's gonna start Tyrese Maxey, but if he did, like Danny Green, I think he would struggle in that Bogdan matchup, because Danny Green, kind of the archetype that really has really given him issues defensively, is those guys who can run through a lot of screens, right, and create space. Doug McDermott's given him issues, Joe Harris, Bradley Beal in that first game of the year, even the second one, I think, when he dropped 60. Obviously those are all kind of different types and caliber of players, but those guys who use a lot of screens off the ball is where Danny kind of struggles, because he just doesn't have quite that quick twitch movement ability anymore at this age. Still a very good defender, did an excellent job against Russ, but it's about kind of maximizing his matchups to kind of make sure he is in the best positions defensively. So he would be kind of the main priority. But I'm also curious what they do against Danilo Gallinari. You know, Matisse did an excellent job, I think, in the first matchup in April. Was it when Matisse held, I think Gallo was maybe 1 of 11 or 1 of 10 from the floor. But are those minutes going to align? Because if Matisse starts and Gallinari comes off the bench, like, it's a little tougher to kind of match those minutes, right? So, and if they don't, they're probably going to be playing small, right? I mean, they have kind of five perimeter options, you know, off the bench, or four, if I recall. I think five, right? That means George Hill, Shake, Tyrese, Matisse, and Furkan, so five, if my math is correct there. And that's tough because, I mean, the Sixers, they go small off the bench. I mean, they start Dwight, and I mean, Dwight is 6'9", right? I mean, like, he's a center, but you kind of forget that, like, Ben Simmons is taller than him. I think when they came out with their official measurements at the start of the year, Dwight was like 6'9.5", and Ben was 6'10.5". I think that'll be kind of the other matchup that I'm curious. I mean, Kevin Herter's the guy who was excellent in that Knicks series, kind of under the radar, and has been very good in his third year here. So the Hawks just have a lot of different guys that can run offense through that sort of Trey. And as good as the Sixers are defensively, you're kind of going to be, you know, exhausting a lot of energy on those guys. And it makes it harder when one of your best defenders probably has to worry about rim protection as well, you know, outside of the perimeter defense. And that's why Joel is so important, because it allows kind of, you know, especially allows Ben, Danny, and Matisse, and even George Hill to an extent, to kind of focus on the perimeter side of things. But now someone's going to have to worry about the rim as well. So Atlanta's kind of bevy of complimentary ball handlers will make it difficult for the Sixers. It poses a significant challenge. And I don't want to say like it's some concern, but it's a challenge that they have to kind of figure out.
This is the point. If Daniel was on the pod, he would talk about his successful online campaign to make sure Danny Green wasn't matched up against Bradley Beal in the first round. So I do want to at least give a shout out there. Because of all, Dan, as you mentioned, Danny is still a great defender, but a guy who struggles, you know, trailing those guys off screens, and Beal was kind of like top option, top caliber player when you think about guys who run around off screens. And yeah, as you said, Bogdanović is another guy in that mold. So yeah, that would seem to be a matchup Doc Rivers would want to avoid with Green on Bogdanović. But and given the fact that he did make the adjustment and take Green off Beal and onto Russ for the first round series, I think he probably recognizes that. You talked about all the perimeter options the Sixers had. Something a lot of people were a little surprised by in the first round was the fact that Doc stuck with his full rotation, playing over 10 guys, which in the playoffs is basically unheard of. Is that something you foresee him sticking with? I know I kind of had the mindset that, oh, it's Washington, let's let all the guys get some action, keep them fresh, see who kind of, you know, emerges. And to Doc's credit, potentially, like, that was something that allowed Tyrese Maxey to really flourish, and now he was one of their most important players as the series concluded. So maybe that speaks to, like, oh, if we had only gone with a 9-man rotation, Maxey might not even been playing, and we wouldn't have seen this. But do you think that's something that sticks moving forward now that, you know, it's the conference semifinals, there's a lot more at stake than what you would think was an easier matchup against Washington in round one?
I would say I expect Doc to go to it initially in game one. Like, I think you'll see all five bench guys get minutes, but at the same time, I think Doc had done a good job in that first round of, like, if a guy didn't have it, he didn't play them big minutes. I mean, like, you know, I think only nine, he basically went to a 9-man rotation in game five. Obviously, that it partly because Joel was out, but he only played five guys over 20 minutes. So I expect Doc to give all five bench guys a shot, but I think you have to pencil in Dwight for some minutes, right? Like, you need him in there. I think Matisse is, you know, if he starts again, you'll expect him to get, you know, 15 to 20 minutes, depending on how valuable his defense is in a given situation. So my answer would be, yes, I expect it to happen, but I also am I'm optimistic that Doc won't go to it, you know, in the second half of a game, right? Like, I think he'll go to it whenever the starters come out. But it's just tough because there's no, like, I think, because you have to play Dwight, and then these three, I mean, kind of your three lead perimeter options off the bench are George Hill, Matisse Thybulle, and Tyrese Maxey, and they all kind of bring different skills, but I think they're all important at the right moment. So I think it's just, you know, I think I was talking with Daniel about this yesterday. It's just a matter of, you know, it's, I think it's okay. Like, I think it'd be totally fine to, you know, consider playing nine guys in the rotation, but that means you probably actually only want to go eight deep. Like, if you need a little more offense and if you need kind of an offensive defensive guy, you go with George Hill because he blends both. If you need a little more defense, you go with Matisse Thybulle. If you need some creation, you play Maxi the heavy minutes there off the bench. So I expect Doc to go 9 or 10 deep initially, but I think the important thing will be, you know, having those options, but not playing all those options on a given night, being very selective in that, but knowing that different matchups will different situations will dictate kind of who gets the most minutes off the bench among Matisse, George, and Tyrese, and even Furkan to an extent. I don't think the way Shake is playing, he really warrants involving himself in this, or that we should involve in this discussion right now. I think he could play, but I just don't think his play has been up to par as of late. But Furkan is a guy who can get hot and kind of, you know, we saw him, you know, almost help kind of bring them back in game four with what he can do. And he clearly seems to have a good chemistry with Ben, especially in transition. So I think that considering Furkan too much might be a mistake, but I think he at least warrants kind of consideration there because of what he can do as a shooter and kind of the way he can kind of flow with the hot hand, the confidence that he can get when he hits a couple of threes.
Yeah, especially with, you never want Ben and Dwight out there too long together, but it seems unavoidable that there are going to be some minutes given if Joel's not available on a given night. So Korkmaz is the, hey, we need as much spacing as possible to help kind of alleviate that logjam that creates having Ben and Dwight. So, you know, he's a guy that can help with in that area. So, yeah, I agree. I certainly don't think Korkmaz is going to be completely out of the rotation by any means. How about for Atlanta? I know a lot of people out there might not have, you know, caught up too much of that Hawks-Knicks first-round series. Are they a team that Nate McMillan has his firm rotation set, or are they more similar to Philadelphia in that they're still kind of figuring stuff out at the back end and looking to different guys on a given night off their bench to help them?
I caught three or four of the Hawks-Knicks games early on in the series. I think in game one especially, I think, and maybe game two as well, Nate did go to an all-bench lineup, so we might see all-bench versus all-bench between Doc and Nate in this series at one point. But
in the year 2021.
Yeah, in the second round of the playoffs with an Eastern Conference Finals trip available. I didn't catch all of them, so I didn't catch some of the later games because my kind of motto was, like, if you've seen a one Knicks-Hawks team, you tended to see them all. But I caught enough of them that I think... Gallinari is a mainstay. Kevin Huerter is a mainstay. They both, you know, Gallo struggled offensively, but he did some good things against Julius Randle defensively. As I said earlier, Huerter was very good on both ends in the series. And then, you know, they played Okongwu a little bit off the bench, but they would also go to Collins at the five. You know, Collins obviously is a starter. Lou Will would play somewhat, but Lou Will, I think, you know, every call had a tough series. Solomon Hill got a little bit of run. But, you know, I think it was one of those things where it was maybe similar to Doc in that when the series began, they went 10 deep. But as it kind of progressed, they would go 8 deep, 7.5 deep, 9.5 deep, things like that. So where maybe you're seeing guys in the rotation kind of on first cycle, but then as the game would progress, they would not get as much run, which is, I think, what you saw from Doc at times throughout that first round. So he's got a couple of mainstays in Huerter and Gallo, who I think are pretty, you can pencil in significant minutes off the bench. But other than that, I don't, you know, I think that McMillan kind of, he kind of tapered off down the stretch of playing kind of an entire bench unit, pretty significant minutes, or not just entire, but I would say five deep off the bench at times. So that's kind of what I've seen. I think those, you can expect Huerter and Gallo to play. But beyond that, it might be something where you see Lou for 8 to 12 minutes a night, a Okongwu if maybe Capella or Collins in foul trouble, but maybe get 5 or 6 minutes outside of that. But he kind of does have a couple of guys he likes to bring in, it seems like. And then other than that, it's not a super deep rotation where he has five guys playing 18 minutes off the bench.
Okay, gotcha. So we've talked a lot about Embiid not being available and what that would mean on both ends. Let's go against the grain here and bring a little potential optimism to Philadelphia basketball. And let's assume, you know, he is back on the court sooner rather than later. Clint Capella is a guy that, you know, one of the better big man defenders in the league. I think if you had to single cover Joel Embiid, he would probably be on the short list of guys you could try that with. how do you think Nate McMillan would attack that matchup, and do you think he would be comfortable with Capella in one-on-one situations against Embiid, and what do you foresee him doing as far as where would they bring the doubles, and how would he try to, you know, stop the MVP finalist?
Yeah, I'm trying to think back, because I mean, we did see Capella and Joel play twice this year, or maybe three times, because I mean, Joel played all three games. If I recall correctly, I mean, I could be totally off base, my memory could just be lying to me, I think they did play Capella in single coverage a lot against Joel, and Joel, I mean, Joel had that huge first half in that game back in January, which is the only reason it was close at all before, you know, before halftime or whatever. So I think they'll go single coverage. I think if they would bring a double, it would come from a guy like, I would probably bring it from a guy like DeAndre Hunter. You know, I think Hunter is someone who could match up with, you know, if Joel plays, you know, because obviously Capella will guard you know, Joel. If Joel plays, I think you'd see Hunter as kind of that guy to put on Ben, because he's, I mean, he's kind of the mobile, strong, you know, wing size player with, you know, so I think that's where you'd bring help from. If you're going to double, if you're going to at least shade help, you know, kind of maybe splitting the difference a little bit there, but splitting the difference doesn't usually work against Joel. You either got to commit hard or kind of stay at home. So I expect, you know, Capella to get first crack in single coverage, but I think at the same time, he's so important to what they do. I mean, like, I think kind of the plus minus numbers have been great all year for Capella. I mean, they just don't have someone else who can anchor the defense like that, because their backup five is a rookie who's 6'8", 6'9", in Okongwu, and missed part of the year with injury. So, you know, I that's what I expect. But, I mean, that's kind of, I think, if you're looking for a reason that the Sixers could kind of maybe comfortably win this series, it would be that Joel Joel plays, and he's so good with his foul baiting still that he gets Capella into foul trouble in four or five games or however long it goes. And the Hawks just can't really function defensively without Capella in there. So that would be kind of the way that I think you should be most optimistic from a Sixers perspective. And Joel is certainly up to the task, because he's fouled out or gotten many, many centers, even very good ones, into foul trouble throughout his career, especially this season. So that's kind of my long-winded way of saying that I think Capella will get first crack, but if they do bring help, it will be with DeAndre Hunter and maybe a guy like John Collins, who, you know, isn't as mobile as Hunter, but is someone who has kind of some mobility and size, you know, kind of on the perimeter as a help defender.
Yeah, I would say the most likely is whoever is guarding Ben, because mm-hmm. if he's along the perimeter, you don't have to really worry about him. And Hunter and Collins are both guys who size-wise you would think could feasibly be the coverage matchup for Ben. So it's going to be up to him to make smart cuts, and if he's in the dunker spot, create availability for himself to get those little dump-offs from Joel if the double does come. All right, so we got to do it. It's prediction time. And if obviously the huge asterisk involves Joel Embiid, so if you want to do your best Doctor Strange impression and imagine multiple timelines where Joel does and doesn't play and give different answers, I'm okay with that. But how do you see this Atlanta Philadelphia second round series playing out?
Yeah, I think I was on a Hawks focused podcast yesterday evening, and I got the exact same question. I think if Joel plays most of the games, or maybe over half the games, I'll say that as coming my caveat here. I will say Sixers in seven. I would have said Sixers in six if Joel was fully healthy. I think this is still a tough matchup for them, regardless of Joel's status. But I think Joel is good enough that I think he could get Capella into some foul trouble in a few games, and then the Sixers would really kind of would thrive in those minutes, and they would maybe win a couple of games comfortably. But the fact of the matter is, even if Joel plays, he's not going to be 100%, which is unfortunate, because he was playing such incredible basketball before the injury. I mean, kind of staking his claim as someone who had a case as the best player in the world, honestly, the way he was playing that first round, the control he had on both ends. But if Joel does not play most of these games, I think I would honestly go Hawks in six, and that's not because I think the Sixers can't win. It's because I think Joel is so important with what to do on both ends in this matchup that I just think they would struggle. And I think the Hawks are a very good team. I don't think the fact that they went 41-31 and have the same record as the Knicks and almost the same record as the Heat is indicative of what this team's quality. They have star power up top with Trae Young. They have complimentary ball handlers. They have shooting. They have lob threats. They have a good defense. They kind of went through two or three iterations of their team when, you know, with Lloyd Pierce and then with Nate McMillan. You know, DeAndre Hunter was out for a stretch. Bogdan Bogdanovic was out for a stretch. This is a really good team that I think, even if the Sixers are fully healthy, would give them some issues. That's not to say I think they would beat the Sixers. I don't think they would if the Sixers were fully healthy, but they're just not right now. And so I'll go Sixers and seven if Joel plays more than half the games, and if not, I'll go Hawks and six. But I think that's a really good team, and I would not discount their ability on both ends.
Yeah, I agree. The Atlanta and six if Joel is not playing. I just think the Trey and his lob threat kind of combination is something that the Sixers don't have an answer for if Joel's not on the court. And then they would have to like keep up offensively, and they're just not a team that's built to just keep up offensively with teams, especially without Joel as that safety blanket of, hey, you can just dump it to him and get buckets whenever you want.
And in this matchup too, where the Hawks have some guys to maybe like on the wings, as we mentioned earlier, like they have the Hunter, the Collins, the Gallo that they can throw on Tobias or Ben to not necessarily like contain, like stop them, but it's a much better option than anything Washington had last round. So it's a tough matchup in that regard, but yeah, I agree with you there for sure.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how Tobias plays in the series, because the whole narrative around him has shifted, like given his past postseason struggles in Philadelphia, and he was so excellent in that Washington series. So is it that he's grown as a player and this is just who he is now, or is just Washington the best possible matchup for him because he was either going against a big man who he was much quicker than, or a guy that was not nearly his size and he could just body them up and get to his spots and shoot over them easily? It's like, if you're Tobias Harris, you couldn't have a better opponent to face them with the Wizards. So yeah, as you said, Atlanta has plenty of very credible wing defenders, and it's going to be up to him to rise to the occasion and keep playing well for sure.
Yeah.
All right, Jackson. So you said Sixers and seven if Joel's available for at least half the games, and Atlanta and six if not. If Joel's not available and Atlanta does pull out, how do you think this season would be viewed? Would they just chalk it up as one of those freak injuries that, you know, you can't really help injuries and that's just how it was? Or do you think, what would the overall feeling of a second round loss for the Sixers be?
I think it would be a missed opportunity, but mostly outside of their control, because at the same time, there is the foundation of a sustained title contender, right? Like you trust the front office now with what Daryl Morey has done in the past 6 months or 8 months since he was hired, and they have avenues to continue to improve. Like if they want it, if somehow some guys become available in the offseason, like you have all your draft picks, you have Matisse Thybulle, you have Tyrese Maxey, you have guys with fairly like easily movable contracts and Seth Curry and George Hill. Like you have avenues to, you know, improve your team. And that, so I'm not saying like we won't like immediately trade Tyrese Maxey or Matisse Thybulle, but you have a very, very good front office guy that can, you can feel confident and will make the right move if the time comes. And you have Ben Simmons, who was a top 25, 30 player, and you have Joel Embiid, who, you know, I think, you know, there's so many guys who are top five caliber. So I would just say Joel Embiid is a top five caliber player, because it just depends on kind of your preference, but that's what you need to win a title. And you have that in Joel, and you have the coaching and the front office decision makers to, you know, amplify that. So I think this season would be viewed as a missed opportunity, but one largely outside of their control. I mean, like you just can't, like it's no one's fault that Joel got injured. Like, I mean, people can say, oh, Joel needs to like play, like change the way he plays. Like, he just came off of the year where he's an MVP finalist, is probably going to be the runner-up. Like, I'm not going to tell the dude to change how he plays. Like, I'm not, like, you know what I mean? So I would say it's just a missed opportunity, but one that isn't their fault. Like, it wasn't because they, you know, they, Doc should have played player X more minutes, or he should have called this set more often. It would just be one of those things. If your best player and MVP finalist, you know, is compromised, it's tough to win like that. So missed opportunity, but there should still be a lot of optimism around this team over the next 3 or 4 years because of the players they have in place, the strides that a guy like Tobias made, and the ways they still can improve and maybe acquire a little more high-end talent and maybe a little better perimeter shot creation, you know, when things can get kind of slowed down in the playoffs.
Yeah, Joel, I think to his credit, has done a really good job of, you know, learning how to fall better and kind of avoid some of those injuries that he was suffering earlier in his career. And I don't think this was really a situation of him being like over aggressive or anything. It's just, you know, it's basketball. These things happen. So
He's a 7 foot, 280 pound center who plays like a 6'4" wing. Sometimes you're going to have these things happen. So
exactly. Well, hopefully that's that. What what you laid out, while I think was well thought out, is not something we have to contend with, because the Sixers fans are certainly hoping that Embiid will be back fairly soon, maybe even game one, we'll see, and that the Sixers can take care of business in the second round and move on to what would be a highly anticipated series against the Nets or the Bucks. But for now, they do have a really tough matchup with Atlanta, and they're going to have to take this one step at a time. So, Jackson, thank you for joining us and for joining me on the Talking About podcast. Daniel will be back next week. I know you had a recent Mikal Bridges article that's really good on Dime Up Rocks. Anything else out there you want to plug right now?
No, I think that, I mean, I appreciate you shouting that out. That would be kind of that tick. That was a lot of work. So, you know, some on my Twitter, you can find that at @JackFrank_JJF or on Dime Up Rocks. Really enjoyed writing that about Mikal and glad the reception to it has been positive. But appreciate having me on, Sean. And I hope that I wasn't too doom and gloom for all the listeners. I think there's certainly a very reasonable chance the Sixers still win this series, and that's what's most important for them. So appreciate having me on, though.
All right, yeah. No, I think you brought the right amount of skepticism. That's the Philadelphia fans' comfort zone, is that level.
Measured skepticism.
Exactly. So, yeah, thanks again for joining us. And everyone out there, Daniel and I will be back next week to talk about what's going on in this second round series. So thanks for listening.